would you define that as a dashboard? I'm almost... Hi everyone, welcome to a new episode of Data Stories. My name is Enrico Bertini and I am a professor at New York University where I do research in data visualization.
Right, and my name is Moritz Stefana and I'm an independent designer of data visualizations. And actually I work as a self-employed truth and beauty operator out of my office here in the countryside in the north of Germany.
Yes, and in this podcast we talk about data visualization analysis and generally the role that data plays in our lives. And usually we do that together with one or more guests.
Yeah, that we invite on the show. Today we had a super special position. So usually you have to know we record through like an online recording tool and Enrico is in New York, I'm on the countryside, but today we're both in Berlin.
Yes.
In the same room. We even have Florian, our sound engineer, around.
Yes.
And we have three guests here.
Three guests.
So we used the opportunity to finally do a proper live recording, which is awesome.
I don't know when. Did we ever have three guests live?
Nope.
No. It's a first, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
And we're just coming out of Information Plus, which was great, which was on the weekend in my old alma mater homeschool in FH Potsdam.
Yeah.
And it was a good conference. I think we should do something about it when the videos are
episode?
Out.
Yeah, we should do that.
It was a really good conference. And now there's the VIS conference, the academic conference, and loads of events around it. There's an arts program, a Data Stories listener meetup tonight. So
yeah,
we're excited
so
for that.
Pumped up.
And another meetup on Thursday. So Berlin is just right now the center of gravity for data.
The center of gravity, yeah.
So, and we said we want to use this opportunity to bring a few people together on an episode we wanted to do for a year almost now.
Yeah. So that's, I have to confess, that's one of my favorite data visualization projects out there. So I'm really happy to be talking about peak spotting. And we have the creators, all the creators of this project here. So we have Christian Au, Stefan Thiel, and Christian Lesser here. Hi, guys.
Hi. Well,
hello.
And of course, Moritz is also involved in the project.
Yeah, I have this funny double role that I'm both a guest and a moderator today.
Let's see how this goes. So guys, maybe you can briefly introduce yourself. We can start with Christian.
Sure. My name is Christian Au. I have been the initiator and head of peak spotting at Deutsche Bahn and am since February of this year a professor of strategy at the University of Applied Sciences in Mainz.
So I'm the second Christian Lesser, and I'm a freelance data visualization and interaction designer here based in Berlin. And I did in this project user experience design mainly.
And my name is Stefan Thiel. I'm co-founder and managing director of Studio Nant, a data visualization and interaction design studio here in Berlin. And there's an extended team behind me that also worked on peak spotting, of course. So shout out to the team there as well.
And former guest.
And right? Former guest, yeah. Just looked it up, 2012.
2012?
Wow. Yeah. Number 11 of the episode. Wow. You guys did an amazing job like doing data stories for so long. It's really great.
Yeah, so we want to talk about the project, of course, and I think we should start by describing peak spotting, right? What it is about. I didn't mention that it's about visualizing the German trains, but Stefan, you can maybe start and explain to us what the project is about.
Yeah, I mean, peak spotting helps manage the capacity of the vast German railway network. So, as you can imagine, you have a large team of very diverse people that Christian can much better introduce in terms of their roles in managing this network. But from traffic control to yield management to traveler steering, so make sure the travelers pick the routes that they are going to be most happy with in their travel experience. So there's a large group of different people, and we support them with an interactive visualization software that makes visible predictions of train loads 100 days into the future. So it's like a little glass bulb looking into the future and figuring out what's going to happen in the network in a certain amount of days, and to help people do actions about those potential bottlenecks. Yeah. Where are they happening and when are they happening?
Yeah. Would you define that as a dashboard? I'm almost.
Sorry.
Want to go right to? Let's go right. Jump head first in.
How would you call it?
I would really call it an interactive interface application. Yep. It's a tool rather than the notion of a dashboard is always like, you know, showing people data they might care about one way or the other, but sometimes they don't even understand or are being picked up as users. That's all of what we are going to talk about. But it's really important to not treat this as a one way to the user, from the data to the user, but also for the users back to the data. And this is, of course, all the aspects we find fascinating about it. So it's an interactive application.
And it has no speedometer.
No speedometer.
Not a dashboard.
No. Not yet.
No glossy graphics and 3D pie charts and
we have a nicely animated dynamic map though, which serves a great purpose, but also we can talk about this later.
At its core, it's basically an application where you can get an overview of 100 days in advance and just see, oh, what will be the worst days in terms of passenger loads. Go into a day, see a lot of different views on that day, understand the bottlenecks, different systemic problems, and then go into individual trains even and individual train legs and understand exactly how the booking situation is on these trains.
Mm-hmm. So how far ahead can you predict?
The predictions always work 100 days into the future from any given day you are looking at it. So there's always predictions generated for next 100 days.
That's based on some machine learning type of...
Yes, it is. It's also this model takes into account previous bookings, other contextual data at some point in the future, hopefully.
Yeah, it does. So there's actually quite a sophisticated model behind that that does the prediction for not only the trains, but also the legs on the train services and different booking classes, first and second class.
Wow. Germany is also unique in terms of traveling. So that's why, I mean, people can always go on a train to travel, but you will tell a little bit maybe about this, right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, maybe Christian, you can just explain how the project started. How did it start?
Yeah, so the idea was actually born, I think, around Christmas 2016. And we had on the 23rd of December in 2016 a situation where we predicted a very high load of passengers that wanted to use our train services. Mm-hmm. So it was actually the day with the highest amount of traveler that we ever had seen in the system, more than 500,000 people on a single day. And these people were planning to take one of our 800 plus train services. And there's a group of experts that Stefan already mentioned, revenue managers, people in traffic control, that were actually responsible for handling this load of passengers. So making sure that they are distributed equally or at least distributed in a way on trains that there is no overbooking or an overload. And that's something that's very peculiar about the German railway system. It's not like other European railway systems or airlines where you have to book a seat in advance or a ticket, but it's rather a metro system where you can hop on and off at any point in time. So you don't need a reservation, you don't need a ticket, you can buy the ticket on the train, which is very convenient for customers, obviously, because it means you can, you know, at last minute decide that you're taking a train, but causes some issues on the side of the... of the Deutsche Bahn when you want to make sure that there's no overloading. And overload can mean that there are basically more people than seats on the train, which is not that critical, inconvenient, but not critical. But of course, from a certain point on, there are so many people on the train that you're not actually allowed to go further and have to stop. People have to get off the train, which is inconvenient for the customers and also causes delays in the whole system. Yeah. So that was basically the challenge. And the more people you have in the system, the bigger the challenge is. And these experts that were managing the passenger load basically really had to focus on two quite simple questions at first sight. Where and when do we have situations in the network where we have a critical overload situation? And unfortunately, so in December 2016, we had already a lot of, you know, sophisticated models that predicted the passenger load, but there were no tools or no adequate tools to really look at this data. So the tools that existed back then were basically more or less table.
A spreadsheet kind of
thing. Yeah, exactly. I mean, they looked like spreadsheet with a lot of columns, so more than 30 columns. A lot of the color gray was involved, and it was always focusing on one train. So you basically had to choose a train, and then you saw the predictions for one train.
Yeah.
What was missing was basically the view of the whole system. Yeah. And it was
lots
also...
Lots of trees, no forest.
And it actually was also, I mean, when you wanted to look up a train, or let's say three trains, you really had to go to each single train and basically take notes and that kind of stuff. So that was not really convenient. And so for this December 23rd, the day where we had this high amount of passengers, at the end of the day, everything worked out fine. But we realized that, you know, we need to upgrade our game. And actually, users were trying to empower themselves by printing out diagrams, path time diagrams or Mare diagrams, and highlighted with text markers, basically, the you know, the passenger load of the train. So we saw that the users basically wanted additional ways of working with the data that we couldn't provide with the tools that were existing back then. And that was basically then kickstarting this project, or, you know, the idea of, well, let's see if we can bring in some real experts, the data with SWAT team that basically really helps us in getting better at that, because we had good data.
I can confirm they look like a SWAT team.
Almost.
So that was the idea. And so we had basically, we had a very good data model that we could use, and access to data, which is, I mean, extremely valuable, as everyone knows who has been involved in these kind of projects. And so we thought that, you know, there must be a way to really use this data in a better way to answer the questions, these basic questions that the users had, in a more efficient way.
Yeah, I really like the fact that you started from questions, right? Because people normally start from data, right? But even the way you describe it is like people have these questions. And I think that's...
I think that was a critical factor to get the project on a good path. I remember well, so Christian wrote this first email introducing the problem and, you know, the challenge. And it was quite crisp and clear in terms of, okay, we have tried these things. We have this type of data. We know we can get this far with standard tools, but now we also know we have this additional need for custom visualizations. And then it was also clear, okay, this is a great opportunity to do something good. If it's already so clear, you know, what the purpose of the tool is and why it's needed. Often clients approach me and they just think they need a visualization for various reasons, but sometimes not really the best solution.
Yeah,
even,
I have to say, after the fact, seeing the project for me was like, oh, finally, some solid stuff out there. It's a real interactive visual. I would call it visual analytics system. It's evident that it's really, really useful to someone. And
the way I was also very eager to prove finally. I wanted personally, it was on a mission also to prove that this type of web-based, highly custom-crafted visualization can deliver a value that is high enough that, you know, justifies the extra work and the risk that goes into building something unique rather than buying a ready-made solution.
And you know, sometimes... some people may say, but that's a narrow set of people that you're serving, but they have a really relevant role, right?
Yes.
So I see a lot of potential for these somewhat narrow applications, but they do solve very complex and important problems that ultimately have an impact on a much larger
group of people.
And I think so, to your point, you know, where did we start? We actually didn't start with questions, but with decisions that people
had to take.
So the question was, how can you influence basically the load factor of trains, and then you basically talk about decisions that specific roles can take, and in order to answer this or make good decisions, they have to have some informations or answer themselves questions. And that is that was the starting point. That also means, and I think that's something that probably when we talk about the users and how it is used, I think shows, it's important to understand, you know, the specific user, and that then also means that the tools are used, because if you're not specific enough, then sometimes it looks great, but there is no direct connection to your everyday work. And that then means a lack of usage.
Yeah. So maybe we can talk a little bit about what happened right next. So the SWAT team came, right? And I don't know, Moritz, you want to talk about a little bit about the process that you guys followed?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Because also in the beginning, I was most involved, and this is often a role I take. It's like figuring out what to do and what the rough direction of everything is. So, Christian provided us with the data sets and the data samples. So that was important, having real data to work with, clear objectives.
Yeah.
And then we did a lot of early experiments, quick prototyping, a lot actually in Tableau. Mm-hmm. There was, which I often do anyways, but there was a nice, it was nice in this way that also the team at Deutsche Bahn and Christian had some experience with Tableau, so they could use it directly, test it out in realistic settings with real data. So we were in the position to really quickly try realistic prototypes
and
figure out which forms
step,
of visualization actually deliver which value. And then, as usual, you hit some wall with the pre-made tools and you get a bit frustrated why the color scales keep changing.
Yeah.
And then you build your own sort of system in D3 and React. So we have a good setup by now to also quickly whip up custom design code. And I think we built this first prototype probably in a couple of months, I would say, that already shows the main views that are also later present in the application. Mm-hmm. And this was the most important basis then to say, okay, this is something useful. This will be useful if we add the following features or if we make the following modifications. And then we went into this in a more structured production process with a larger team and really rolled out a first prototype after another few months that later was the basis for the production version.
How does it work? You make sketches or you use what comes out of Tableau to get initial feedback from people?
Tableau prototypes, a custom code prototype with different variations. At some point, we also printed out different UI elements, like here's a map, here's a list, here's a calendar. How could we combine these? How would you go through these when you search for
and
this
you show
type of
this thing? To the end users and you
right.
get feedback?
And together with them, find out which combination,
so some sort of, focus groups
which combination
kind
of views makes sense, which order of things makes sense. And this relatively quickly turned into this information hierarchy from left to right, drilling down through time from left to right by going into descending panels, basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. And then later, so this is all, quick and dirty, sort of also abstracting a bit from the really complicated stuff, defining the basic skeleton of the application and the basic workings. And then, then also people like Christian Lesser, for instance, came into play, who can sort of get these rough sketches into something that actually works well.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah, so I guess I came in when the first prototype was there.
Yeah.
And this was really like interesting to see, like seeing the first prototype, how this already worked. And I worked, I guess, at the site architecture, first of all. So we refined a little bit, how do you drill down those to the trains? So this was really important, I guess, to really get something stable there. And then we went to the headquarter and interviewed the people again, did some interviews, watched how they're working, what other tools they are using, really user-centered, so to say.
Yeah.
And then I did some wireframes, of course.
Yeah.
But the good thing was that the prototype was already there. So this was more like refining how we would like to have it instead of really like building everything from sketch from a design tool, like or from from sketch or from Photoshop or something like that.
Okay.
So it was more like a ping pong. So this was really great for the beginning. And then I had the chance to really like, when we were finished with the prototype, like the real prototype in June, to figure out, okay, what features should come next. How should we change certain things? So I did a lot of interviews. This was great. And we had the opportunity to track a lot of things. So we could combine the qualitative research by asking people with tracking their behavior. Because sometimes you ask them, but they don't really realize what they are doing because you do so many things automatically, right?
Yeah.
So we were able, so we did another visualization that visualized how they go through the whole system.
Yes.
So we figured out when are they clicking where, how do they search? And we realized there are other maybe user groups that also using the system in a different way.
So how many users are we talking about, roughly speaking?
That's a good question.
Is it the order of, say, 5, 10, 20,
You have to
15?
Differentiate between the regular users that use it on a regular basis and the total amount of unique users that we have.
So I guess unique users we had or we have 1,600.
Yeah.
I would say groups maybe are 3. What do you think, Christian? 3 to 5?
Yeah, I think they're heavy users, like in traffic control, use it every day and several times a day. I'd say a group of like around 10 people.
Yeah.
And then you have at revenue management, people who use it depending on the day, for example, around Christmas and Easter. There's really a peak in the number of users that you have probably 20, 30 additional users that work heavily with the tool. And then there were really a lot of people who also from top management just, you know, used it to understand how the traffic situation is basically on a specific day, since it's always helpful if you communicate about, you know, how basically the passenger load is, not only to tell them, well, you know, we have an average passenger load of X percent, but basically, you know, you can look at it, you see on the map where the passengers are actually going. So there are a lot of people that use it probably on an on and off basis, but so these are the three type of groups, I'd say, heavy users.
One idea that Christian also brought in that I find really exciting is the idea of UX metrics. And this is based on the Google Heart framework, which is like a bigger, like conceptual, but also technical framework, mostly a conceptual framework for how to, on the one hand, define very well which type of behavior you're aiming for, at the users, but also defining how you measure if you get there. And often people just focus on how much, you know, views or how many views volume. But sometimes you also want specific actions to happen specific qualities of happen. And we are set up to both define it, but also measure it. So we understand if the design we do actually does the right thing.
So I guess the HERT framework stands for happiness, for engagement, adoption, retention and task success. So the good thing there is, so you set goals, what you, for example, we have this comment window where you can put comments in there. So, and we
about
said,
a single train or a part of a train.
So what we would like to have, that we want to figure out, okay, how can we increase the engagement, right? That you put more comments in there. So how do you then figure out, okay, you need a signal to really count how many people doing comments. So you have the goal, you want to reach to rise engagement. You have to signal the amount of comments, maybe. How many maybe people are looking for that comment or group that comment. And then you come up with a matrix that means like per month or so. And so what we do right now is, like, we had the tracking in the beginning. That means you count everything, so to say. But then for a specific feature, now we go with this kind of metrics to say, in the beginning of these features, we say, okay, we want to reach this. And through a certain time after, like, developing these features, we are tracking the signals. And then figuring out, okay, did it work? Should we change it? And so on.
So the ultimate goal is to see if you have to make some changes in the UI to... say optimize,
or if changes we make have the right effect, basically.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's full data inception because now we have visualizations about our visualization.
I love that.
So we measure how people use our visualization showing the data.
It's recursive.
And always, and it's also one important part is oftentimes complex features are built for a very long time and then they are made available to the users. So, and we decided to, go a very lean approach to build something very, very basic and see how are they using it. So in the context of comments or notes, right? We looked at what are they and what are they entering in terms of text. And then this led for us to a more, like, to the insight that comments are more used like a tagging system, let's say. And this is how this very small iterations contribute a lot to the evolution of those features across the app. So not doing everything at once, but really start with the MVP and then just build it out gradually from there on.
So then the system is in place. People are using it, I guess, very successfully. So what's coming up next? You're still working on the project, right?
Yeah, I mean, the exciting thing about it is it's a long-term effort. There's tons of different requirements, interests, and other needs to look at similar or the same kind of data or similar data or maybe even adding contextual data to what we are doing right now around the
like
predictions.
Weather,
events in Germany. Those things also have a great impact on how the trains are being used. And so... we have this setting for further development, which is organized loosely around iterations, in which we say like, okay, we gather for like one or a couple of sprints and intense further development phase for around like one and a half months. Then we let it sit for a while, look at how it's used, and help use this to re-inform the next stage of development. And then from all sides, there are impulses coming in to the team. It's like, hey, also this would be interesting, or could we also build this? And then we have to also see how we not let it grow in such an extreme ways that the UI system becomes incoherent and that the user interface remains feature creep. We need to make sure we also transition it into a nice modular system that can handle multiple different roles and workloads and requirements to usage and still have a unique and coherent design system and also visual language that is consistent across the entire
application. When the kids are growing up, you know, things change.
Exactly.
As you know, Enrico.
And I guess, and I guess, maybe you get requests also from your users of features that they may want to have.
Not just the users that are related closely to the tool. Sometimes it's really interesting which other departments within Deutsche Bahn are getting in contact with us because they find it also useful, and that these are things are that we would have never been able to estimate at the beginning of the project. It's like a little wave that kind of like, or a little like, a chain reaction that happens there because people see it and say like, oh, that would be great for what I'm doing. And so there's constantly new input arriving at our desks, and it's a sometimes also a challenge, but a nice one to have to integrate all of this into Peakspotting.
And I probably would add that at the same time, I think that there, you know, some tasks change of people that are working with the tool. So that also has to be reflected in the tool. There are sometimes changes in what kind of data can be used, right? Probably a little bit more precise or additional data sources. So the tool basically, I think, needs to evolve with the needs of the users. And I think that's also the challenge, you know, to make sure that you understand which user tasks probably have to be adapted or which have to be prioritized besides the long list of requests.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, one thing we should also mention is that, well, we are used to building quick projects and putting them on the web or in exhibitions. You know, we're more in this realm. And now we did the first time something in a big corporation like this. For sure. And also, it worked really well for a couple of reasons. You know, we're lucky that everything came together that way to build such quickly such a focused product. But now we also have the task, of course, of integrating it with the larger corporate infrastructure, fulfilling all the requirements that software and the context needs to take, the politics. And these things are not to be underestimated.
Of course.
And if we think about why don't we see more of these cool, innovative solutions, I think a big part is also what needs to go around it is much bigger than the actual, like,
of course,
cool visualization. And it's a whole ecosystem, actually, micro ecosystem that needs to come together.
And for a team that is mainly consisting of trained designers who, of course, also know technical things very well, but it's kind of, it can also be challenging or a little bit scary if you think about the actual potential that this application could have, integrating it into the live operating systems. So right now we observe data and people do actions based on what they see. But what if the actions can be done directly from within the app or even at some point automatically? Because, I mean, this is sort of the entire process on the long run that we are going through, is to figure out what processes can we observe that we can automate in a certain way, but then you're starting to have an impact on the actual railway system. And that's, it's an exciting thing for such a well-designed tool to kind of grow into that role, but also it's a very high responsibility. And,
I think what you are mentioning here is a very interesting aspect of how visualization can be a way to transition, intermediary way to transition to more automation, right?
Yeah.
Because you need first to understand something, and then once you understand it better, now you can automate some of it, right? Is that correct, Christian?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that...
nodding.
what Stefan also mentioned is that data visualization can be enormously helpful in different phases of working with complex data. And so I think that really a lot of firms, at least in Germany, have invested a lot of money in the last 5 to 10 years and resources in bringing together large sets of data in data lakes or whatever you call them. And now they are accessible and usable for fancy algorithms. But that is something to enable really people interact with the data where you need data visualization. Yeah. And in the first stage where it's not even about automizing decisions, it's really about understanding complexity by providing a synopsis. And the other thing is really to de-average the view, right? To give you the aggregate number, but also enable you quickly to understand what are the data points behind that, which is extremely important, because if you're looking at the whole system and say, well, the average passenger load is X, that doesn't really help you. You need to understand how the spread is between the trains. And then if you move on basically into a world where you add not only, you know, you don't only have complex data, but you add some sort of signals to the data that people should focus on, because by techniques like machine learning, you identify interesting points, right? Whatever interesting means, it could be like data points where out of experience you think these are trains where you should really put a focus on. Data visualization is again crucial to make sure that you can do that quickly, you know, quick filtering signal from the noise. And I think the final transition is indeed then what at Info Plus was, you know, presented by Fernanda and Martin from Google, that if you are in the last phase where you have automized decisions, you need some sort of way to explain to users what happened. Because I mean, these still are, even if we don't look at decisions like, you know, the train has to start to stop here, but even revenue decisions or yield decisions, there needs to be some sort of explanation on why the system decided to do something. If you don't have that, people won't trust the system. And since the people that are responsible for that stay the same, they need some sort of help transitioning in a world where more and more algorithms really, you know, make decisions, or at least are part of the decision making.
Yeah, I guess you don't want to mess up with the railway system, right? Yeah. I mean,
no, and even with the revenue side, right? So if it's not about safety, but if it's, you know,
losing money, And that's what, but that was also one observation that we had in the user interviews, let's say a traffic control or something like that. There was a very human observation that I made of Deutsche Bahn, because I assumed many more decisions were already kind of automated in a way. But I realized many decisions on a daily basis have to be done by humans, and they need to write it kind of information. They can make these decisions on how they want to, you know, if a train should leave earlier or wait a few minutes or something like that. They do these decisions, they make these decisions, and that's also fine. Like, if they decided in this way, it's a very critical phase of 2 minutes. They decide in a certain way, that's fine. They don't get any like bad consequences because it's a high pressure situation, but it's a very human system. So that also changed my perspective as a traveler on this network. And imagine if you as a traveler even get this kind of information on why something happens in the network in according in a certain way, that would be extending even peak spotting to the public, you know.
And it's actually amazing if you look at, I mean, some of the people working with the tools, they, you know, do this type of job for now 10 or 20 years. And sometimes the way that they, based on intuition, experience, make decisions is actually, well, really good, right? Amazingly well compared to what you would have if you just used an algorithm. So you also need to somehow take this knowledge and intuition and gut feeling that you probably can't even put in an algorithm and make sure that it's still accounted for at, or some sort of a hybrid decision making that, you know, presents people information that the data or the algorithms come up with, but also leaves room for their decision making, a better informed decision making.
Yes.
Oh, that's a very exciting conjunction between people, data, algorithms, right? And my sense is that we're still discovering how to do that, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, that's one of those projects that help probably everyone understand how to do that better, right? I think that's another reason why it's exciting. And I think another interesting aspect is that here you are innovating within a really big corporation, right? Not corporation, organization. And so how do you move steps within? I'm surprised that you managed to do something so innovative in such a big organization. How do you do that?
You stay under the radar.
Yeah, right? Stealth mode.
Stealth mode. Yeah. You make a the small
data,
little...
Right? The data visualization squad comes in and stays very stealth mode.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would love to see more projects like this blossom, right?
I mean,
I would encourage our listeners, if you see any opportunity to do anything like that, I would love to see more of that, because that's the real deal.
Besides the design process, we can also talk about a little bit about this, but I would like to talk about the organizational aspects first. The most crucial thing is you need to have someone like Christian who knows where to get what from the organization? What kind of data, what kind of support in managing parts of the infrastructure or making sure we have a fast way through some decisions or something like that, right? You need someone who is who's an ambassador within the organization that understands the value that is about to be created and is also, frankly, being able to take on risk. Yeah. That is involved with this process, because innovation is always like, I mean, in the end, it's all good. It's innovative. Yay. But it means also you can fail. Innovation is controlled failing. you try out things and they go wrong. So you need someone within the organization who acts like an ambassador and knows the organization very well and can make sure you don't get too much attention too early.
Yeah.
You need to stay under the radar, to be left alone, to be able to get to a concrete result. And once that result is done, you show it to the organization, and then people will get all kinds of, like, you will get attention, and then you have to moderate that. But before that, you will never get to that point if you have too much attention too early in the process. That's super important.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, looking from the internal perspective of organization, you need some, how to put that, leg space. You know, it's, so that really depends on the setting. If you're setting up a project like this, so in my case, basically my boss was very, you know, willing to give us a lot of leg space and saying, I mean, sounds great. Go ahead. We started actually with quite a small budget, which was very helpful, because I mean, it enables you to just start and then based on workshops, come up with something that is tangible, and then you can create in our case, I think, excitement and people willing to say, oh, you know, that looks interesting. Let's move a step further.
Small snowball first, and hopefully it turns into a bigger one.
And then we had also, I mean, that probably you mentioned, Moritz, the pieces of the puzzle that have to come together. We had also really a good team on Deutsche Bahn of, you know, the people that were representatives of the roles that we were designing the tool for. Right. So in all the workshops, there was always for each role someone who was a representative who basically tried to give feedback on what is useful, what is helpful, and was really open-minded in doing that, which is, you know, needs to be there. And I think that existed in this case.
I guess what I found as a designer was really great that we didn't had an NDA, so to say. Christian was really open and to say, hey, we put it into the light, right? We bring it to awards. We want to show it. We show what we do here. Of course, we have to fake the data, but we were able to really present the tool. Because I guess a lot of companies doing those kinds of tools, but you don't see them.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Yes, it was really like bold from you to say, hey, I show it to everybody.
Yeah.
Well, that, again, that's also a decision, you know, in the case of Deutsche Bahn, where you have to go to your boss and ask. So I have to give this credit probably then to my boss back then. But yeah, I think that's probably true, right? I was also wondering in how many cases you have these type of applications that are just not shown to the outside world, because people are still, at least in Germany, very skeptical about sharing. I mean, not the real data, because we're not showing the real data, but about showing these kind of tools. On the other hand, what I've also heard that people at Deutsche Bahn think it's good to share it because it also attracts talent, right? I mean, of course. It's good if you see that an organization develops these innovative tools and works with certain type of technology. So that's actually something that companies should be more interested in, because they want to attract
Airbnb, Salesforce. Exactly, yeah. They put their tools out in the world because they know it's a proof of competence.
Yes, exactly.
But in Germany, the situation is a bit different.
Not many corporations understand that point, especially in Germany.
Yeah, I want to see more organizations like that competing on this, designing and realizing these type of tools. It's a great trend. And I guess the overarching lesson learned is find good people within organizations to work with.
Well, and probably just to add the piece of the puzzle, that is also important, the SWAT team, right? So I think that we, in our case, really had a great team. I mean, looking at people sitting here at the table that, you know, came up with really great visualizations that people really liked. And of course, that's also crucial. You know, having a really great product that depends on the experts that know what they do and can, you know, create a lot of excitement.
But alone is not enough. So it's necessary, but not sufficient. That's the thing.
Okay. Well, thanks so much. That's been a lot of fun interviewing you in live.
For real.
Congratulations for this great project. And I'm looking forward to hearing more about what happens next.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey folks, thanks for listening to Data Stories again. Before you leave, a few last notes. This show is now completely crowdfunded. So you can support us by going on Patreon. That's patreon.com/datastories. And if you can spend a couple of minutes rating us on iTunes, that would be extremely helpful for the show.
And here's also some information on the many ways you can get news directly from us. We're, of course, on Twitter at twitter.com/datastories. We have a Facebook page at facebook.com/datastoriespodcast, all in one word. And we also have a Slack channel where you can chat with us directly. And to sign up, you can go to our homepage, datastory.es, and there is a button at the bottom of the page.
And we also have an email newsletter. So if you want to get news directly into your inbox and be notified whenever we publish an episode, you can go to our homepage, datastory.es, and look for the link you find at the bottom in the footer.
So one last thing we want to tell you is that we love to get in touch with our listeners, especially if you want to suggest a way to improve the show, or amazing people you want us to invite, or even projects you want us to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. And don't hesitate to get in touch with us. It's always a great thing to hear from you. So see you next time. And thanks for listening to Data Stories.